the story and meaning of Sojourner Truth.
I wanted to not have her be an iconic character, that there was something accessible. Yes, she was one of the movers and shakers of the 19th century. But every single one of us can make the kind of choices, can be courageous, can make a choice for the better.
That's Jacqueline Sheehan. We talked to her about her novel about Sojourner Truth, The Comet's Tale.
I would like her to be remembered as a person of enormous intellectual power.
And that's historian Nell Irvin Painter, author of Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. Finally, we talk to the creators of the play, Sojourner's Truth, I Will Shake Every Place I Go To.
When I was sold, I had a severe, hard master. And I was tied up in the barn and whipped. Oh, till the blood run down the floor. And I asked God, why don't you come and relieve me? If I was you and you was tied up so, I would do it for you.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome to the second episode in The River Runs Through Us, our special six-part series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. Today, we examine the life of 19th-century abolitionist and former slave, Sojourner Truth. Truth was born in New York State as Elizabeth Bomfrey, but she has a special connection to the Connecticut River town, Northampton, Massachusetts. She lived there during a crucial period of her life when she began to come into her own as a leader. And it was on her journey up the Connecticut River Valley to Massachusetts that she had the spiritual revelation that gave her her new name, Sojourner Truth. Today, we examine her life, what she learned and did in Northampton, and the meaning she holds for us today. We first talk with novelist Jacqueline Sheehan. In 2003, her novel about Sojourner Truth was published under the title Truth, but she reissued it in 2011 under a new title, The Comet's Tale. I asked Jacqueline Sheehan why she changed the name of her book.
Well, in the very beginning of the book, one of the ways that I wanted to show the kind of the way that an enslaved parent would try to stay connected with her children was that the mother would tell a story about each child's birth. And I fictionalized a story that Sojourner's mother would have told her about her birth. And that story was that she arrived on a comet's tail.
This was a story that you have some reason to believe that she would have told her, or it was one that was just made up out of whole cloth by you?
Yeah, no, it was just made up by me. But I do believe that oral tradition is how parents stayed connected with their children by telling them stories about the other children who were sold away and stories of their birth.
Actually, Sojourner Truth's mother is quite a powerful figure in this book, and her father too, less so. Did you know anything about them? I mean, is this also something that you got from the research that you did, which I understand you did a lot of research about this. Did you find out things about Sojourner Truth's parents?
Mostly what I was able to find out about her parents, and I, you know, it took me 5 years of writing and research to do this book, came from her narrative that she dictated to Olive Gilbert right across the river in Florence, Massachusetts, because there would not have been much at all written about Sojourner's parents since they were regarded as property.
Now, Sojourner Truth, we're going to call her Sojourner Truth, although she didn't get that name until she was already a grown-up. Mm-hmm. She was born Isabella into slavery in New York, in Dutch New York. Dutch was actually her first language. Could you paint a portrait for us of what her life was like as a child, as a slave child, living with her parents on this farm?
You know, that was really the most compelling part of the story. And it, for me, it was an untold part of her life. You know, and as a psychologist, it's the question I always want to know with people who have that sort of resiliency and they survive unbelievable things in their childhood. But I want to know, how did you survive? What did it take for you to survive? What pulled you through? And I wanted to know that about Sojourner Truth. And again, this took a lot of research about especially how northern slaves were treated in general, which was not one bit better than southern slaves, although I think the people in the north wanted to think that they were treating slaves better, and really, we were not. How children were regarded as compared to, say, livestock. So I wanted to paint a picture of what it was like to grow up as a female slave child under those conditions, also knowing that at any minute you were going to be sold away from your parents.
In fact, there's a part early in the book when Isabella is a child and she's really being treated like livestock. Well, not livestock. She's being treated as if she is a dog. Mm-hmm. And her mother gets very indignant.
So there's information that I could have presented in a very academic kind of way. But I did not want to do that. The whole point of historical fiction is that readers can enter the character and learn from the character what this kind of life was like. So I could have gone on and on about the research that I had done about how slave children were of lesser or equal value to livestock or to a well-trained dog, a herding dog. But instead, you know, I fictionalized an account that let Isabella experience this. And she does not have political knowledge. She doesn't have the knowledge of what's happening in the bigger picture. She has knowledge like any 8-year-old child would have. And yes, this would have been the thing that would have put her mother, Mau Mau Bet, over the edge.
So then, was she about 12 when she was actually sold away from her parents?
She was between 9 and 10 when she was sold from her parents because of the death of one of the slave masters. And they sold off all of their possessions, including these children.
And then she went to much more difficult circumstances. And you paint a portrait here also, the slave owner's wife, who is quite uncomfortable with her role as a slave owner, and rather than that making her more humane, it actually makes her less humane.
Well, yeah, and again, you know, it's that dehumanizing people so that we can call them slaves dehumanizes the people we call slaves, but it also dehumanizes us, and that's what I was trying to show with these scenes. So here is this wife, a powerless, completely powerless person in society at that time, unable to vote, really unable to speak in public. And she is put into this position of managing a slave child and really does not know how to do that. Not all families did. And this was a merchant who had just become wealthy enough that finally he could attain a slave child. And it was dehumanizing to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sojourner Truth, who was still at this time called Isabella, slavery was on its way out in New York, but she managed to almost free herself a year earlier. How did that come about?
Isabella was an extremely powerful, physically powerful person, and she was famous for her physical prowess, and John Dumont, who owned her, you know, would brag about her. He would brag about her strength and say things like, you know, she's as, you know, as strong as a man, but yet she can work domestically in the house. Wow, what a bargain I've got. But she was aware of this, and she was beginning to have a consciousness, I think, of what was fair. So all of the black people in the area knew that slavery was coming to an end in New York State. And so Isabella had this conversation with John Dumas, and she said, look, I have worked unbelievably hard for you. I would like to become free a year early. I've earned it. And they had a sort of relationship that, you know, they could have conversations of some depth, according to her. And he had promised her this. And when he reneged on his promise, she saw him suddenly in a different light. That not only had he owned slaves, but he had lied to her. And that was the line in the sand for her.
He wasn't her friend, actually.
No.
Then she went off and ultimately got to New York City for a while. What was she doing in New York City?
Well, she was working as a domestic, but working for herself, deciding who she would want to work for. But she was also in New York City in this time period of great religious enlightenment. It was a really exciting time to be in New York City. And she was very swept up in it. And in her effort to be able to speak to God, to become a religious person, she ultimately made some horrible choices.
She got involved in a kind of cult.
In a cult. Can't call it anything else.
Yeah. And you know, the resonance of Sojourner Truth's life is very modern in some ways. You know, it seemed like the first New Age movement in a way, with all kinds of, you know, people who were sincere, but also people who were charlatans.
And if you think about Sojourner Truth's position, she's still Isabella at this point, but up until age 30, she had been owned by other people. She had been told who she could have children with, who she couldn't have children with. Really, all of her choices were dictated to her. She had a sense of being able to talk to God because she really got that from her mother, who instructed her, no matter what happens, you can talk to God. And I think she held on to that, but she was not permitted to go to church. So freedom comes to New York State. She goes down to New York City, takes her very damaged son, Peter, with her. And she, I think, wants to take this ability to become a spiritual person as far as she can take it. And she runs into this group that is enthralled with somebody called Matthias, who claims really to be able to have contact with God in this very personal way and be able to interpret the word of God. And she makes the choice, like these other actually very well-educated, well-informed people, to believe him.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jacqueline Sheehan about Sojourner Truth. Her novel about truth is The Comet's Tale. So what happened then? I mean, things began to fall apart when they moved to upstate New York.
Well, they moved to what was then Sing Sing. And he was operating out of the cult playbook, really, I think. You know, he was dictating to them who they could mate with, who could sleep with who. He was dictating what they could eat. And of course, all of their finances were going to him. I think we've heard this story before, and we'll hear it in the next few centuries. But she had a kind of loyalty to him, and the entire group blew apart when one of the members became sick and died.
Hmm. And she left, and she became involved with another cult, with the Millerites.
Yeah, not very much, though. Mm-hmm. She was not involved with the Millerites very much. She was very cautious mm-hmm. after being involved with Matthias. She still attended church. You know, she really became a seeker. I don't know what else to call her, but she was a seeker of spirituality.
And she had a kind of religious epiphany, which is how she got her name, Sojourner Truth.
She was in her mid-40s, and God spoke to her. And God said to her, I'm renaming you. I'm naming you Sojourner Truth. and the rest of your life is to be a preacher, to bring the word of God to other people. And that's what happened.
Now, she could not read or write. She was illiterate. Mm-hmm. But she was a powerful speaker, I understand.
You know, that is my deepest regret, is that we have no recording of her voice. When I was doing research, every newspaper account that I read of what her voice was like was some variation of the reporter saying, "The hair on the back of my neck stood up when I heard her voice." And she would usually end her speech with a song. She would sing, and apparently she had a beautiful, resonant, inspiring voice.
Mm. Well, the Millerites, which we mentioned before, they were a kind of a millennial cult. Mm-hmm. That's what brought her up to this neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
How did she make her way from New York to Northampton?
Well, she went through Connecticut. So she was preaching and asking about, she was looking for a place. It's amazing that she had this much faith after having, you know, found a group that blew up and was disastrous, that she was still looking for a group, and she would always do that the rest of her life. So I think her last stop as she was coming up through Connecticut and Massachusetts was someplace in Chicopee, and she was talking with somebody, and they said, "You sound like the kind of person who should go to Florence," and described where that was. And she continued walking, and she arrived in the Florence, Northampton area.
And what did she find there?
She found the Association for Education and Industry in Florence, which was a utopian community, and it was based on one person, one vote. What she particularly liked was that everyone had to do an equal share of work. And she was pretty delighted with that when she found it. She always said there was no high, no low in this particular group.
This was also a group that was in favor. It wasn't just a utopian community. They were also active in the abolition movement. And she met two great Black anti-slavery fighters, and that was Frederick Douglass and David Ruggles. Tell us a little bit about her interaction with these two men.
She was older than Frederick Douglass, and you know, Frederick Douglass was a very well-educated, fantastic speaker, and I think he felt that Sojourner Truth could sort of get on his case a little bit. And he sometimes reprimanded her for that. He got on sort of a high horse with her about it because, you know, he looked at her as she couldn't read, she couldn't write. And it was important for him politically to be seen as a very well-educated man. So I don't think he always wanted to affiliate with her. With David Ruggles, however, he was one of the most interesting people who I found in history. He was a Black abolitionist. He had started out in New York City helping people on the Underground Railroad. Actually, he helped Frederick Douglass. But he was sort of a frail person, and he became ill in New York City and began to lose his sight. He was quite blind at one point. But he was an unusually brave person, and he made the decision, "Well, I'm going blind, but I think I will just continue to operate on the Underground Railroad and try and save as many people as I can." Well, his friends said, "David, you have to be, you've just lost your mind, we think, because you have a price on your head. People would willingly kill you. You're going blind." And they sort of escorted him up to Florence, where he regained a bit of his health. He opened a water cure hotel in Florence, of which there were several.
So Sojourner Truth also now blended religion with her anti-slavery work.
She did. I think her political sense was really developed in Florence. She was surrounded by abolitionists. She was surrounded by this kind of talk and exposure to what was happening politically. And she did. She blended it with her sense of spirituality, with her sense of justice. It was not just the abolitionist movement, it was the right of women to be able to vote. And in her later years, she fought against capital punishment.
Wow. And we're talking about Sojourner Truth. We're talking with Jacqueline Sheehan about her novel, The Comet's Tale, a novel about Sojourner Truth. She bought a house in Northampton. She lived there with her two daughters, or two of her daughters. But then she left. Why did she go, and where did she go?
Again, she was looking for a community of like-minded people. So she moved to Battle Creek, Michigan. She was most affiliated with Quakers, but she was now on a full-time lecture tour. Not over the entire United States, but definitely the Northeast, as far out as Michigan and back again. She was also very involved in supporting soldiers, especially black soldiers, in the Civil War.
And did she meet Lincoln?
She did meet Lincoln. And I did I could only fictionalize that meeting because we don't know exactly what that was like. There are many different accounts of it. There is her account of it. There is another person's account of it that does not particularly jive with Sojourner's. Sojourner was completely taken with him. Other people have said that the issue of slavery for him was very, very complicated, and that it was not that he was completely against slavery. He very much wanted to keep our country together.
Right, but then he did free the slaves. He did the right thing. People don't always do the right thing for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But therein lies historical progress. This book, you know, Jacqueline Sheehan, we've talked about a number of your other books now and then. I mean, I think we've had you on maybe at least two other times, perhaps mm-hmm. three. I do now see, which I hadn't before, the common thread. You've been a psychologist. You deal with issues of abuse and resilience. So, of course, that very much is a story of that. I found this book, you know, I've enjoyed all your other ones, but this one I found incredibly powerful. I almost felt that you're really in love with this character, with this person. I wonder, is there something about the fact that you were writing a historical novel about an iconic figure in American history that made her really special to you as a character?
I think what I wanted to do is I wanted to not have her be an iconic character, that there was something accessible to all of us about the choices that she made, that you can have horrible life circumstances, and that you can make choices. For example, she went through a period in her life when she hated white people. You know, that would sort of be a logical conclusion. But because of her ability to kind of see the goodness in people, she really chose that instead. I mean, she could choose to hate a particular group of people, or she could choose to see the goodness in everybody. She was not blind to the negative parts of people. That wasn't the case. So I particularly wanted people to know her childhood, which to me is always the most compelling part of somebody's life for some reason. And I did want people to see that, yes, she was one of the movers and shakers of the 19th century, but every single one of us can make the kind of choices, can be courageous, can make a choice for the better instead of for the worse.
Well, it's a terrific book, and I'm so glad that you brought it out again, and now in a 2011 version. It's now called The Comet's Tale, a novel about Sojourner Truth, and we've been speaking with the author, Jacqueline Sheehan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In addition to The Comet's Tale, Jacqueline Sheehan is the author of the best-selling novel, Lost and Found, as well as the novels Now and Then and Picture This. You can read an excerpt from The Comet's Tale by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, historian Nell Irvin Painter talks about Sojourner Truth, The Seeker for Justice. Stay tuned after a short break.
slavery in New York State. Her parents couldn't save her from cruelty and hate. She prayed for mercy, and eventually they passed the law and set her free.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Sojourner Truth came to Florence, Massachusetts, a small hamlet in the river town of Northampton, she went from being mainly a religious preacher to becoming a political activist in the service of equal rights for all. During her stay there from 1843 to 1857, she got involved in the twin movements of abolition and women's rights. Earlier, Jacqueline Sheehan told us a bit about how Sojourner Truth came to the progressive community of the Northampton Association. Historian Nell Irvin Painter is the author of Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. I asked Painter to fill in more about the story of how Truth came to Massachusetts.
Sojourner Truth moved from New York City to Massachusetts during the summer of Millerism, and she moved along a network of Millerites. Millerites were people who believed the world was coming to an end, and she did too. So Sojourner originally meant somebody is here just temporarily, and she has to preach her truth. When the world didn't end, Sojourner and Truth came to mean something slightly different, itinerant minister. But she moved along a network of people who shared her convictions, her religious convictions.
Once she realized the world wasn't going to come to an end, what were her religious convictions?
Well, when she realized that, she was in Northampton, and she was with this wonderful group of abolitionist and women's rights people. They were a commune. And so as she was with them, she started paying attention to their views.
When you say they were a commune, what do you mean by that?
The Northampton community was in a great big industrial building, and people shared work. Everybody worked. There were sort of dormitories. The Northampton Association really was founded along lines of equality and sharing. So women were equal and black people were equal. They talked out what they were going to do. It was like a big co-op. And so when she first came there and she saw how sort of primitive the living situation was, she really didn't think she was going to stay very long. But the people were so open and really welcoming to her that she decided to stay, and over the course of a few years, she began to think as they did. It would be very difficult for an African American in those times, in the 1840s, to be pro-slavery. So Sojourner Truth would have had some anti-slavery ideas, so it wasn't a big shift for her, but she began to speak less about the Holy Spirit, less about the end of the world, less about religious ideas, though she never quite gave them up, and more about equal rights and the evils of slavery.
Nell Painter says the Northampton Association's commitment to abolition grew out of its philosophy about work and class.
The idea was to abolish class differences and class oppression, and to have people work together and talk together so that everybody would work. Nobody would be exempted. There would not be an elite that just lay around. And so the people of the Northampton Association were very much against slavery, largely because of its class bias, that it was so corrupt and oppressive for working people.
And so what would a typical day be like for Sojourner Truth there at the Northampton Association?
She worked in the laundry. So she was not involved in silk production, everybody would have gotten up very early and probably taken their baths in the cold river and then gone to their various jobs. A man who was a child in the Northampton Association later made a drawing of her at the washtub from memory or from imagination. So she would have probably worked all day doing the laundry. She complained when people gave her clothes that were too dirty or too much. And then they would have had uplifting visitors and talks and meetings and then met together in the evening to decide who was going to do what and how the association was going to proceed on a daily basis.
Don't stand back and look on.
We're talking with historian Nell Irvin Painter about Sojourner Truth. Painter was just telling us about the Northampton Association of Education and Industry, the cooperative community Sojourner Truth lived in from 1843 to 1857. It was in Northampton, Massachusetts. And do we know anything about how people received her there or what her role was?
Yeah, we know somewhat. Because at the time, this is the mid-1840s, she was not a truly famous person at the time. So there was no carrying on about, oh, we've got a celebrity in our midst. We know, for instance, that Olive Gilbert, who wrote down the narrative of Sojourner Truth, thought that she was a remarkable person. So that was clear right away. But also thought that she was kind of coming to the end of her life. And so as Olive Gilbert conceived of the narrative, it was going to be an object for Sojourner Truth to sell to people to support her in her old age. But we know that in 1850, when she began her abolitionist speaking career in a big way, she was about 53 years old. So she started a new life as what would have then been an old person. She seems to have been there with her daughters, who also worked. Now, what I found absolutely fascinating was the difference between Sojourner Truth and the Northampton Association and the young Frederick Douglass, because like other abolitionists from eastern Massachusetts, they use the Northampton Association kind of like a progressive summer camp. And Frederick Douglass was just honing his skills as a young person in the 40s. And so he would read and he would speak and he would practice. He was making himself into an educated speaker, whereas Sojourner Truth was an inspired speaker. And she kind of made fun of his attempts to elevate himself, and he kind of patronized her. So she was a generation older than him, and they had different approaches to getting through a public life.
And what kind of a speaker was she?
She was an inspired speaker. Her roots were in extreme Methodism, called Perfectionism. And she once said that she liked to speak to hear what she was going to say. So when I say she was inspired, I mean that she didn't prepare in the way that Frederick Douglass did. She did not read and write, so she could not follow Douglass in reading the papers and commenting closely on current affairs or politics and so forth. So she spoke more like a minister or preacher, I should say, than a journalist.
And why did she leave the Northampton Association?
She left first in 1850 with George Thompson, a British lecturer, because she wanted to go around to abolitionist audiences to take part in their discussions. When I say abolitionists, I should say they were also women's rights. Equal rights, peace, women's rights, anti-slavery, all of these were part of the same movement. So she was embracing meetings of people. Sometimes they were more toward women's rights, sometimes they were more towards anti-slavery. But these were places where she could meet other people, where she could take part, and where she could also sell her narrative, which was her means of support.
And that narrative was written while Sojourner Truth was at the association?
Yes.
And then the Northampton Association closed down, but Sojourner Truth stayed on for a time.
It closed down in, 49, was it? So it was at its peak in 1844-45 when she was there, and it closed down in 1846. So it lasted from 1841 to 1846.
And she left or she stayed?
She stayed. She stayed in Northampton in Florence. For a while she lived with the Benson family, but she preferred to live on her own. So she actually bought a little house. There's a picture of the little house in my Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. And she actually owned that house until about 1855-56 when she moved to Michigan.
The silk mill of the Northampton Association of Education and Industry was situated on a tributary of the Connecticut River, the Mill River, which supplied the power to drive its machinery. As we'll hear later in this series, The River Runs Through Us, the Connecticut River itself was the engine that powered much industry along its banks. I asked Nell Painter whether the river also powered the flow of ideas.
Well, certainly that's how Sojourner Truth got there, because she moved up the Connecticut River from Old Saybrook on a network of like-minded people, a network of Millerites. So absolutely, yes, it was a river of ideas.
And finally, Nell Painter, I wonder if you have any last words for us on what Sojourner Truth means for us, for our American heritage.
I called my book, Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, because I wanted to draw a distinction between the life that a person lived in history and what we have made of her, the symbol. And the strongest and most perplexing embodiment of that symbol is, ain't or aren't I a woman, which Sojourner Truth didn't say. But that's what we need her to say, because we need her to be the woman in black power and the black in feminism. So that symbol is a person who is a minority in two different streams of liberalism, I guess you would say. But in terms of her actual life, She was a remarkable person of enormous intelligence. And I think the symbol in American life kind of takes for granted that her wisdom, her sort of mother wit, I suppose, came from having been a slave. Well, millions of people were slaves, and there's only one Sojourner Truth, so there's clearly much more going on than simply that atrocious and tragic history. So she was a person of enormous intelligence. She was very eloquent. She knew her Bible inside out and could use the symbols and the personages in the Bible in really a way that went very deep. So the more I studied her utterance when she used biblical characters, the more I saw that what she was doing worked on many levels at the same time. So I would like her to be remembered as a person of enormous intellectual power. But also, she had a kind of emotional resilience that allowed her, she would say with the power of the Holy Spirit, but allowed her, even while she was enslaved, to confront the family that owned her about selling her son to Alabama. She was not the only enslaved person and not the only enslaved woman who did that, but you can count the numbers on the fingers of one hand. So that kind of power, that kind of bravery, is also extraordinary.
Nell Irvin Painter. She's the author of Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, as well as The History of White People, Creating Black Americans, and Southern History Across the Color Line. Next up, the Enchanted Circle Theater's take on Sojourner Truth. Here's a song from the production. It's
summer
called
day,
Where I Want to Go.
When nights are never long, summer days I can feel so strong. I watch the sunset tonight, and I hope everything'll be alright. Yes, and I hope everything'll be alright. So my reflection and my fears went away. Standing up now, I have the courage to say, I am a mountain reaching for the sky. I am an eagle soaring high. I am a river and my heart just flows. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. It's so inspiring to see the places I could go and who I could be. Influenced by those who came before me, it's time for us to fulfill our destiny. I am a mountain reaching for the sky. I am an eagle soaring high. I am a river and my heart just flows. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul. I am beautiful, I feel it in my soul.
Holyoke, Massachusetts is a mill town on the mighty Connecticut River. It's home to a unique theatrical company, the Enchanted Circle Theater. The company's work is about inspiring learning about history by integrating arts and education. It does this through what the theater describes as living history performances put on in schools and communities, retelling history through theater and using primary sources for texts. An example is the theatrical concert Sojourner's Truth, I Will Shake Every Place I Go To. Writer's Voice associate producer Drew Adamick spoke with the Enchanted Circle Theater's playwrights, Rachel Kuhn and Priscilla Kane Helwig, in their workspace overlooking the Connecticut River canals. He asked them to describe the play. Rachel Kuhn went first.
Well, we're calling it a theatrical concert in part because music is such a, it's an underbed. So there's the music of the time throughout the course of the piece. And the piece involves Sojourner Truth and one of our actresses playing sort of all the white women who are courted in her life and who worked with her over the course of her life. And then we have a present day narrator who's a young woman who really brings the story into present day focus. So the story happens kind of back in time and takes the audience through the timeline of Sojourner Truth's life, really birth to death, with a narrator who's a musician with a guitar, pulling out into present day and connecting the dots for students as to why this story from way back when has any relevance to what's going on for them today.
And the character of the narrator, storyteller, musician is really important in terms of our audience. It makes the piece, as Rachel just said, it brings out the relevance of the story today. And, you know, as far as we have come, there's far to go in terms of giving people voice and the ability to get past difficult times into better times. And so the actress who played our narrator storyteller is a young woman. She had just graduated high school, and she was a singer-songwriter, and she had written a beautiful song called Where I Want to Go. And I heard Stephanie sing this song, and all of a sudden, past collided with present, and she's really talking about what's important to her and standing on the shoulders of giants and being able to do things for herself that she couldn't have done before. And so it's really, you know, how far have we come and where do we need to go?
Sojourner Truth was born a slave. She was born not English speaking. She never learned to read or write, and she ultimately freed herself, freed her, some of her children, and was able to go on and travel the country speaking about equal rights. And so she became a leader and came from, I mean, so she traveled pretty far in the course of her life. She died, they think, in her mid-80s. And so one of the things that Stephanie says at the beginning and the end is really about, I see Sojourner's life as an inspiration. And, you know, if she could do this, imagine all the things that I could do. And there's a lot of power in being able to make choices. There's a lot of power in sticking to what you believe in and standing up for what you believe in. And Sojourner Truth did that time and time and time again. And so for us touring the show in a lot of urban schools in this area, it's a pretty potent message from someone who really didn't start with a whole lot of luck or good fortune in her back pocket. She really traveled extraordinarily far. And so I think that's a big piece of the mm-hmm. message and why it felt like a really valuable lesson.
The playwrights had to contend with many different versions of Sojourner Truth's history.
So many people have told Sojourner's story. There are so many different perspectives on what was her true story, what did she really say, and sort of all these versions of the truth that can be very distracting.
And how did she say it? Did she have
right.
a Southern accent? Did she have a Dutch accent? Who is she interpreted by tells the story.
And once you dig into that, we really struggled with what is it to say that this is the truth of her story.
We also felt very responsible in the interpretation because, you know, you are interpreting someone else's life and there are choices you make. It's tricky waters. And as many people have the Ain't I a Woman speech, you know, it has been reinterpreted and retold many, many times and often with a Southern accent. Sojourner Truth was
Dutch.
And lived in the North, lived in New York. And so that's, I think we were being very mindful and respectful of wanting to tell a story we could tell. For me, one of the things that was really clear was I wanted to let music be one of the storytellers, and that music as oral history. And so I spent a fair amount of time researching spiritual music and the use of song as a way of telling history is really powerful. And so from start to finish, there is music throughout. It's there as this sort of steady current. And as a link to her spiritualism, she is said to have had a very deep, resonant, powerfully moving voice as a singer and as a spokesperson.
There's the narrative of Sojourner Truth, which is as close as you can get to her real story, even though she sort of dictated it, so you don't know what happened in the transcribing of that story. But we, you know, early on decided that that would be a lot of the backbone of the story, and that the bulk of the text of the play is primary source text. So it's not like we went off and kind of extrapolated and wrote a whole bunch of things that sounded about right, as we really tried to stick to primary source document material. And we also used a historical timeline, and it's to really give a sense of not only the arc of Sojourner's life, but her life as it happened in the context of what was going on in the country. You know, there's a moment where Stephanie points out that Sojourner was getting the mortgage on her first house at the same time that slaves were being sort of pushed back into the South. The slave law that required Northerners who found slaves to send them back happened within the same year, and so that she had just sort of made these strides in the context of what was going on in the country and the time she spent with Abraham Lincoln and sort of seeing how far this woman came in the course of time and in America's history was, I think, a big factor in generating the piece.
A sense of place and its impact is central to the work of the Enchanted Circle Theater. Priscilla Kane Helwig explains what that meant for the play Sojourner's Truth.
In writing the play and then touring it locally, place is very important because as she was in Springfield, as she was in Northampton, as she was in New York, as we are in high schools and theaters, you know, she stood here many years ago. And, you know, if she could do it, we can do it. And that sense of, again, connecting us to powers within ourselves to do what we want to do and need to do. And I think it does start with place.
And that speaks to living history. I mean, part of what we've done with all the living history plays we've done is breathe a sense of history into either buildings or communities to say, we didn't, you know, sort of like we didn't just arrive here, and so there have been communities before us, and this is the legacy they've left us. And you can walk through Northampton and see the house that she lived in, and you can, you know, you can sort of touch the places that she touched. And for students locally, that's pretty exciting.
And she was real.
It's
within reach.
Yeah.
And then we were, you know, commissioned by the Sojourner Truth Memorial Statue Committee to write the play. And what they were hoping was also to open people's awareness to the role she played here in our local community and to let people know where they can come to find out more information.
Playwrights Priscilla Kane Helwig and Rachel Kuhn of the Enchanted Circle Theater of Holyoke, Massachusetts. Let's listen to an excerpt from the performance of their play, Sojourner's Truth, I Will Shake Every Place I Go To.
When Israel was in Egypt.
In 1817, New York State passed a law declaring that all slaves born prior to 1799 would be freed in 1827. Now, this included Isabella, who was born in 1797, but not her children.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go.
Doing farm labor for John Dumont and household labor for his wife Sally, Isabella worked long and hard. When she went into the field to work, she sometimes took some of her children with her. She would put the infant in a basket, tie the basket by a rope to the branch of a tree, and set an older child to swinging it. Isabella would sometimes stay up all night, afraid to sleep, trying to do her work well enough to gain approval.
I could only speak Dutch, and they speak English.
And this was a formidable obstacle in the way of a good understanding between them.
A fruitful source of dissatisfaction for the mistress.
John Dumont would often beat Isabella.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh.
This was not so far from ordinary.
Let my people go.
my mother said, when we were sold, we must ask God to make our masters good. And I asked who he was. She told me he sit up in the sky. When I was sold, I had a severe, hard master. And I was tied up in the barn and whipped. Oh, till the blood run down the floor. And I asked God, why don't you come and relieve me? If I was you and you was tied up so, I would do it for you.
Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go.
After emancipation had been decreed by the state, Isabella's master told her if she would do well and be faithful, he would give her free papers 1 year before she was legally free by statute. On the arrival of July 4th, 1826,
the time he specified for receiving my free papers,
she claimed the fulfillment of her master's promise, but he refused on account, as he alleged, of the loss he had sustained by having her injured her hand. She pled that she had
worked all the time and done many things I was not wholly able to do.
But her master remained inflexible. Ha! She said, with emphasis that cannot be written.
The slaveholders are terrible for promising to give you this or that or such a privilege if you will do thus and so. And when the time of fulfillment comes and one claims the promise, they recollect nothing of the kind. And you are like as not taunted with being a liar.
But Isabella inwardly determined that she would remain with him only until she had spun his wool, and then she would leave him, taking the rest of the time to herself.
That was an excerpt from the Enchanted Circle Theater's production of Sojourner's Truth. For more information about the play and the group, as well as links about Sojourner Truth herself in Northampton, go to writersvoice.net. You've been listening to an episode of the series The River Runs Through Us, a special 6-part miniseries exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River. Funded by a grant from Mass Humanities, The River Runs Through Us examines contemporary challenges through the creative, metaphorical, and historical lens of the Connecticut River by engaging writers, artists, and scholars in a long-form public conversation. Thanks to Mass Humanities for their kind support. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.